Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00032. Recorded on March 23, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas.
Necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised. Trigger warning. This series deals with topics that may be disturbing. Subject matter may include domestic violence, sexual abuse, and subsequent mental health disorders. If you are sensitive to such material, consider entertainment alternatives.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Now, keeping with the subject matter of hidden origins of unnatural behavior, I'll speak to alcoholism, right? Alcoholism. Again, staying with things that I am familiar with, that I have some semblance of subject matter expertise on. Speaking to myself about these matters, right? I think you go into most any room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the people in there, as they speak, one after another, will kind of relay a foundational idea they have about their alcoholism as something that they inherited, right? Alcoholism as being hereditary. And I'm here to tell you, I don't think so. I got reasons why. And I'm going to go right into it, right? Reasons why. First of all, I should say for myself, as far as heredity is concerned, regarding alcoholism, I go straight up my family tree as far as I can go back on both sides, mom and father, right? Maternal, paternal. Nobody. Ain't nobody up that way that was an alcoholic before me. There's no... And you're going back like four fucking generations. There's no skipping a generation, any of that. It's not there. But I come out and be alcoholic drug addict. Flaming. Right? There's no sign of heredity. So you could think, well, some people inherit it and some people don't. Okay, well, why bother? How about everybody gets it the same fucking way? Let's take the super unknown that I was talking about before, right? That certain something that we're not sure what the fuck happened, probably demonic, possibly, definitely traumatic, possibly damaging, maybe all the above, whatever. That happened and we became alcoholics. Okay. Well, what about the guy whose father was a drunk and his father before him was a drunk, and it's all the way up the tree on both sides? Wouldn't that be hereditary? No, not necessarily. And Quite likely, not at all. What happens in that situation? What happens when you are raised up in the household of an alcoholic or two, you know? Let's just say one, right? Just keep it simple, simple math. You know, one alcoholic in the house, he's a raging asshole. What happens? Everybody gets abused, including you. That's why for mom, they got Al-Anon, right? Because the alcoholic that she was living with made her fucking crazier than he even was. And then that's why they got Alateen for the kids. Driven crazy in the same light. It's an environmental thing. And odds are, if you grow up in an alcoholic household, you're probably going to become an alcoholic. It's not a slam dunk. Of course, the agony that you experience may completely turn you off to liquor for the rest of your life. A lot of people do respond that way. But the environment under the scope of a raging alcoholic is one of abuse. Every kind of abuse. Guy comes home drunk, and, you know, what he says is abuse. What he does is abuse. Some of the shit he does is fucking crazy. It's horrible. It's bad. It's brutal. It's painful. Irreparable. Do I need to go into the details of what the possibilities of a drunk man or a drunk woman are? What a person could come up with in that state of mind? And because it's in the household, you spend, as a member of that household, how many hours of every fucking day of the first 20 years of your life on that battlefield? It's going to do you damage. And it's very likely you're going to turn out to be a drunk. And then you're going to be in an AA meeting trying to tell everybody how your father was a drunk and your grandfather before him was a drunk and you inherited it from them. You did not. You became it as a result of an alcoholic environment. The super unknown entered into you in a moment of abuse and pain, anguish and torment. This I promise, this I swear. You know, the abuse is not just like slapping your mother upside the head, beating you as a son. It's sexual abuse too, right? Sexual deviancy, and it does things to you. It sets, at a young age, what your idea of normal is. It's normal to come home from work, stop off and at a tavern and get yourself a couple of drinks. It's normal to pick up a couple of six packs on the way. Come home, be drunk, beat people, rape people. Within the confines of the household, that's what your normal becomes. Normal is what you grow up in. All this shit is very environmental. I got no doubt. And of course, you know, like I said, once upon a time, a long time ago, if you do come to that point, you do become an alcoholic. That's a forever thing, you know. Once a pickle, always a pickle. Once a pickle, you cannot return to being a cucumber again. So clearly, by now, you must have recognized the fact that I don't believe that alcoholism is something that we inherit, right? I don't think that a disorder of that case, a mental disorder as it is, right, is something that we inherit. I believe in the experience of my process of recovery through all these years, decades, right, that it's a spiritual problem because the solution that I applied was a spiritual solution. The spiritual solution eradicated the problem, therefore the problem must have been spiritual also. It's plain logic. It's very plain logic. Nonetheless, it makes enough sense for me, and it's proven out in my life. right? It's proven out in my life. And when I say a spiritual solution, what I'm talking about, what I'm talking in opposition of, is that science / medicine has not had any fucking answers for alcoholism. And then you look across the spectrum of all the other quote-unquote mental disorders, and everything gets laid in the hands of psychology and psychiatry, right? Psychiatry. And I was going to say psychiatrics. Psychiatry, we'll go with that, right? Psychology is psychiatry. And what solution do they have for people that have, bipolar, you know, any of that, whatever mental disorder you're concerned with? Where's ever been the solution to it, right? It's all been throwing spaghetti at the wall, see if it sticks. Everybody is a fucking experiment on these drugs. And the psychiatrists are fucking drug dealers. Where has it been effective? Because if it has been effective, why the hell is our society so fucked up? Why is it that when I drive home on my commute every night, I could guarantee you like 7 out of 10 cars, the people driving are on some kind of medication, whether it's a narcotic or some psychiatric drug. Something that affects the mind in some way, shape, or form, right? This is why. This is why I have such issues. Because I'm not like that. I am so sober-minded, right? So clear to see. That my awareness is obviously better than somebody who is hampered by drugs, medications, whatever you want to call them, right? My reaction time, so much better. And I make this fucking mistake of thinking that I'm somehow normal, and I put myself as the median in the determination of normalcy. And as I drive down a highway or I walk through a crowded gathering, I expect people to be more like me, and I'm fucking wrong, and I have to apologize to the world as a whole. I'm wrong. I don't realize how much more many people are fucked up than I am. And I hate to say that. I hate to think that. It's not my nature to think that way. I actually have to get a little intellectual to come to the realization that, wow. You're all fucked up, and the best that you can do requires drugs and therapy to get it done. I guess I'll get a little bit more into that whole sort of notion about things. But what I'm really speaking to here is the idea that, hey, science, medicine has not been able to resolve alcoholism, and I don't see it as resolving any kind of quote-unquote mental disorder. All right, this is excluding physical brain trauma, brain damage, as a wounded or improperly developed organ in your skull, right? All that aside, with normal circumstances, as far as your physical condition, the physical condition of your brain are concerned, if you are misfiring on a psychological level, if you are responding to creation and nature in a unnatural way, you have a fucking disorder of one sort or another, right? And when you have alcoholism, that's usually an indicator for other types of disorders. Like in my situation, I had like a chronic major depression, and that's my way of describing it, right? Always. You know, I had that suicidal ideation and romanticizing death and, you know, just the blues, but like on a deep level. And I don't want to get into all the details of it. It was a murky perspective on being, and a real shitty way to go through life. But it was that, right, that really made alcohol and drugs make sense to me. So, the alcohol was just a symptom of an underlying problem. And even that underlying problem falls within that the spectrum of mental disorders that are not some kind of brain damage or physical developmental failure. My alcoholism was a reaction to an underlying condition that had a mysterious cause to me. And I regard such mysterious causes as super unknown, like the Soundgarden song and album. I don't know that that's what they're referring to. Probably ain't, but it might be similar. The demonic nature of it, the picture on the album cover that looks like a demon of some sort, the fact that it, quote unquote, first it steals your mind and then it steals your soul, right? Demonic nature. That's what I mean to say. And it is my belief that something demonic in nature occurred in my life that I'm not aware of that kind of fucked me up. It gave me a mental disorder of a particular type. And having that particular disorder made alcohol and narcotics like medicine to me. And see, I'd be quick to just take what I just said as a concept and just transpose that on all the variants of immorality, you know, and you could figure out immorality for yourself. I'll surely get into that more as we go, but that's not for right here. But whatever you think that may be immoral, even if you don't believe it to be, if you think that it is, you think that other people automatically, by consensus, think it's immoral, A, you're probably right. And just trying to ignore the fact. And B, transpose this concept onto whatever that is. And see if it don't fly. Right? See if it don't fly. For one example, and you're going to hate me for it. I don't believe that same-sex attraction is something that we're born with. I believe it's something that ultimately happens to us. Again, we're born innocent. Otherwise, it's a birth defect. And I don't think that's a birth defect. I could say, hey, let's look at the science involved with it and see if there's actual, like, some sort of off balance, off kilter, chromosomal numbering and shit like that, right? Or some kind of hormone counts are out of whack. But I don't trust the science anymore to do that, because so many people, that here's the thing, right? And I don't mean to berate gay people in this. Let's berate alcoholics and drug addicts, right? We are apt to skew all the data in favor of continuing to drink and do drugs. It's that simple, and it's that easy to do. It's that easy to do. Look, I'm a database guy. I'm a data guy going all the way back for decades. I know fucking data. And you know what? I know how to play with it. I know how to mess around with it. And I know how to make it come out the way you want it to come out. I know how to trick people using certain verbiage. It's not what I do. And it's not that I do it. It's not that was a profession of mine to do. I just know enough about this shit to realize that that's what other people are doing, you know? My information doesn't get out on the fucking mass media news network. those are places that like to tell you percentages of people and what they think in surveys and shit like that. I worked in market research. I literally programmed those surveys in, and I tabulated the results at the end. These results and the surveys themselves, the questions, you can fuck with them. You can do this. It wasn't what I did, but I see where it can be done. Language on the front end is not necessarily clear. And on the back end, the results that you get, you can weigh them all kinds of different ways. You know it, and I know it. You don't have to be a data expert to know this shit, right? So I don't trust the science. Not when it comes to making percentages and trying, and it's coming from a voice that is really trying to shape and mold public perception of something. Ain't happening. No fucking way. No fucking way. So what I'm getting into here is the idea that we all take damage, right? We do. All of us. There is the shit that creates disorders. We'll just call that the serious stuff. But we all get some semblance of super unknown. And it's not just like a one banger. It's not just one time this happens to us. And it's all, there is one time that we all get. That's the one that breaks us out of our innocence, right? We're born innocent. Innocent. See, if we're born innocent, and we are, all right? You might not believe it, but we are. We're born innocent. We cannot be born with some kind of affliction or disorder that has us corrupt, like alcoholism. To be a drunkard is clearly an immoral condition. To be drunk is clearly immoral behavior. As scripture puts it, and it puts it plain. There's some other things you kind of got to work through and look at the original Greek and everything, right? To figure exactly what it means. But when it comes to the drunkenness and the drunkard, that shit is plain as day, clear as the blue sky above. If I'm born drunk, I'm born immoral. That means I'm born impure. Spiritually. Nah. No fucking way. Right? No way. And then other examples of immorality and immoral behaviors fall in the same line. You're a little innocent baby in your crib waving your arms around. Goo goo gaga. A big smile on your face. Right? You're not a fucking murderer. You weren't born with the tendency of bloodlust to kill. Or an extortionist. A thief in general. Now, wouldn't they say, the science say, like, kleptomania is some kind of disorder, right? Not just stealing, but an extended, quote-unquote, crazy amount of theft. You're stealing shit that you don't even need. You're stealing for the sake of the thrill of stealing. There's a disorder there, right? So if you're a thief to the point of a klepto, could you have been born that way? No, because then you wouldn't be innocent at birth. You wouldn't be innocent at birth. This is the way it works, okay? This is the way it works. There's a whole lot of misunderstanding about this sort of shit. On the Christian side, right? The Christian side. This idea of the original sin, right? Adam and Eve in a Garden of Eden. They had their sin, and it changed everything, right? What did they do? They bit into the forbidden fruit. What was the forbidden fruit? The forbidden fruit was the fruit off of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right? So that's what they brought in to themselves and into humanity. That's what got brought into it. It was a change of circumstance. The sin existed. See, the sin existed in Adam and Eve for what they did. Then they gave birth eventually to children. Those children were born innocent, but they were born into the environment of Adam and Eve, the sinful people. And Adam and Eve did something to bring sin into their lives. Or a demon, a devil did. But here's what you have. The sin is not something you physically inherit. You're not born that way. You are born into a condition. You're born into a situation. You're born into a world that is so full of that shit that mathematically you can't avoid it. So every one of us gets hit with that moment where we're taken and ripped out of our innocence and made sinful. And that is the first seed of super unknown that we get. And that can be any of a magnitude of things, from something very innocuous to something very filthy and vile. And to each of us, it's different. And then our experience going forward, all right? See, I look at that as like the hand of Satan. The finger of Satan just fucking falls on you. And at that point in time, the sin has come into your life, right? But that's a metaphoric a way to look at it. But still, run with that analogy, right? Satan puts his finger on you, and now sin has entered in. You were innocent, now you're not innocent anymore. But that doesn't mean that Satan can't come around and put his finger on you again and again and again and start to touch you in appropriate places. And you see what I'm saying? That's where there's variance. That's why some people end up with disorders and are fucked up, and other people are not. And they're just looking around wondering why everybody's all crazy. Nonetheless, they sin in their own way because everybody's touched by it, right? We're all taken out of it. We're all guilty of this shit. It's just, you know, some of us are more quote-unquote damaged than others. But it's not actual physical damage that is done. You could, like I've been referring to it throughout this episode, these chains of episodes, as psychic in nature, but it's really spiritual damage, right? It's really spiritual. And the two probably kind of hand in hand, right? They're definitely hand in hand, no doubt about it. So, now to think about that, you just take that, right? And I talked about the mathematics involved, how it's unavoidable. So everybody gets ripped out of their innocence and brought into an existence of really what comes down to the knowledge of good and evil. And that is your life within sin. This sin is a sickness that is brought to you. You were innocent in the world and a breeze blew through the window, and on that breeze there was a contagion that you caught, just like everybody else. And that is really the nature of sin. It's just everywhere. It comes off of everybody. You can't avoid it. And so, unavoidable and in contact with everybody. That's what the world is, all right? The world is not our physical earth or the universe that the earth is in. The world is this invisible, spiritual web of connectivity, web of sin, that connects people, person to person, everywhere we go, everywhere we move. I walk into a room, there's 10 people in there, my sin links on to 10 people. That's the fucking world. And it's made of that net. That's the way I visualize this place. It's a world of evil. And it all begins with the touch of the super unknown. And it gets worse with more of that in our lives. Now, some of us grow up in a horrible environment where we were damaged in that regard time upon time upon time upon time. Others of us grow in a good environment where we just, you know, lightly touched here and there, just enough to bring the sin in, but not really wrestling with fucking demons over it. the difference between people, but it's still sin nonetheless. We're in it. We're in it. This whole idea of sin and us in this world, this is not about us proving our moral perfection, like our ability to like white knuckle and behave perfectly. It's not about that. Yes, there is sinful behavior. When we use the word sin, there's really two ways you look at it. Sin is a behavior that we do that is a sinful behavior, but that is within the context of sin itself, which is like this net draped over humanity, like I described. Call it civilization, right? That is what sin really is. It's this sickness that's upon us all. And it just connects automatically person to person. Because why? It's spirits. Spirits are moving in and amongst this world. Person to person. And they use us as conveyances. They're fucking hitchhikers on our body. And that's where we get the little voices inside that work on our temptations like they do all the time. Well, I'm just not going to eat any more cheese in my diet. And I'm going to cut those calories out. And then you go to a restaurant and you order a nice grilled chicken breast on a plate with vegetables. And, oh, they give you a side salad. Well, I'll just get the vinaigrette with the side salad, you know. I won't go in for all the heavy Thousand Islands and blue cheese because I can't eat cheese, right? And then it comes out, you got your little side salad there, and it's got little sprinkles of cheddar on top. And you're just, it's just a little bit. And it looks good, you know. It looks good. And really, the vinaigrette's not enough. And, it's just a little, and that's how it does. It talks to us. Now, we may or may not actually ingest that. We may just push it aside and say, fuck it. Or we may just go ahead and take it on. But what happens to everybody, without regard of how we respond, is that voice whispers in us. Where's that voice coming from? It's not coming from the fucking air outside of us. It's running in and amongst us. That's how we differentiate a mental disorder from actual brain damage. One is spiritual in nature, and one is physical in nature. Remember? Physical-sophical. There it is. That's how it's done. So now you got this damage that is being done. What is the damage? Well, when they whisper in the ear and you respond to your temptation and indulge, you responded to the suggestion of sin by doing a sinful behavior. And that's sinful to you. It's not a Bible that says you can't eat cheese. It's not about that. You violated your own rule. You violated your own rule. You broke yourself. Now, broken like that, before any repairs are done, while you have this sense of sorrow and woe and guilt about you, more of these fucking demons move into the situation. You've got no defense against it. And every time we put ourselves in this broken condition of moral failing, we are now vulnerable to the onset of more demons coming in. Or vice versa, when we are strengthened by upholding moral conviction, we have some kind of spiritual defense against that. This is a lot of heavy stuff, but it's truth. It's truth. Absolutely truth. Now, I give you this description of this world, right? This entire world. Like this net of connectivity. These threads that bind all of us, person to person. Conduits that demons travel on from person to person, moving evil about, bringing temptation, and trying to break us and make us vulnerable that they can enter in. I describe the world as that. And in doing so, the world as it is in that regard now becomes what? Subject to the devil, who is the prince of evil. Capisce? What I'm trying to say is, the world is the kingdom of Satan. And this God above, the creator of all things, God Almighty, has allowed for. He has allowed for this for his own means. But really, this is the product of ultimately love. Believe it or not, it is love, because this is what happens with free will. We are given free will to decide for ourselves, to choose for ourselves, and to act on our own accord. You cannot have free will without choices. And everything that is ugly and evil and wicked, which by chance happens to attract so many of us, as it does, right? They're all temptations. But it's all selfish indulgence, ultimately. And that's really where the difference is, you know. We are talking about love and hate here. Make no mistake about it. Good and evil is love and hate. And my sin, personally, is just it recognizable to me. I know, and I believe, and yet, the hatred wells up in me. Frequently. And with that, by that, I know the sin exists in my being. The dead giveaway. But here, we're looking at this, the whole world as being the kingdom of Satan. And I don't know what you think about that. But that's what I think about that. And now I'll go to the Bible and I'll show you exactly how that works and how that flies, right? I could probably give you multiple instances. But we'll just go, Jesus in the wilderness, right? We are during our Lenten fast period now in the church. And that is set out to a duration that is similar to Jesus in the wilderness. Having had been baptized in the River Jordan by John the Baptist, led by the Spirit out into the wilderness, which is the desert in Judea, as it was back in the day, 2,000 years ago. 40 days, 40 nights, no food, no water, to be tempted of the devil. And after 40 days, Jesus was hungry, right? For sure. And thirsty, and the devil came and found him. And he tempted him with three temptations, testing Jesus, right? If you are truly the Son of God, right? The big climactical temptation was bringing him to a precipice that overlooked the whole world. And said, all of this is yours if you simply bow down to me. So my point here is that Satan had it to offer to God. Right? He had the world to offer if he could get this. And he didn't understand the Son of God as being God. Right? He didn't get that theology, obviously. He was trying to rip the Son of God away from God. And bring Jesus under his own rule. But what he had to offer was the world, right? Similar example, a similar example in scripture that people would be generally familiar with usually is Job, right? The story with Job, where God allows Satan to do to Job what he did to Job to test Job's faith, his tenacity, his perseverance, which matters. Perseverance matters. That's all through Scripture. That's another story that I would like to talk about, but not right now. But Job is an example, right? Job has been just riddled with all kinds of affliction and woe and sorrow and grief, death, all kinds of shit, you know? And he kept the faith. But the story is an example where God allows the devil to do these things. And every time anybody who reads that story is like, well, why the fuck is God allowing that? That's like a punishment. That's however actually true it is also metaphoric for certain. It is a story we could transpose in concept onto every one of us, showing that God allows Satan to do the shit that he does. And the shit that happens is done by him. And we endure it as a test, which goes to my concept of our existence here on the world as we know it, what we call quote-unquote life, right? This physical life, 0 to 100 years or so, give or take, depending on your situation, right? Your results may vary. So life as we know it is really little more, maybe nothing more than proving grounds of our faith and our love and our communion with God Almighty. That's it. And as far as we are, right? As soon as you hear me say that and you think, bullshit, fuck that, that's crazy, you're a nut job, right? As far as you are away from getting down with that idea is how crazy you fucking are. That's how far gone you are. You are in this proving grounds and you ain't proving shit. I am here to help. I am here to help guide you along. I am here to help guide you along to knowledge of the truth that God wishes for all to have. So anyway, Job endured Satan's attempt to tempt him away from God, to denounce God. Job wouldn't do it. Didn't make Job perfect. He had his failings in the end too. But he outlasted Satan's assault on him, as did Jesus in the desert, right? Jesus endured the temptations of Satan, and Satan fled. Ultimately, Jesus would have total victory over Satan. Of course, Jesus outranks Satan by everything. But the illegalese involved with spiritual matters, as it was at the time of Christ walking on the world, had Satan's dominion, extending beyond what we call the world, what I've described as the world, and that net over it, his kingdom, down into the afterlife, the netherworld. He also had control down there. There were souls down there, good and bad alike, none of which could be freed. Only ones of which would ever be freed would be the good ones, but they were still trapped under Satan's power. Satan had the keys of death and Hades. Hades is the place of afterlife and death, really. I don't want to get into it theologically, but you got this Hades, which is the afterworld, and then within it you've got a Hades and a paradise, you know, a place of good and bad. There's like two levels of Hades basically involved, and paradise, afterlife for God's children, was contained within that outer shell of Hades, all the same. But that's what I'm trying to say. The dominion of Satan at that time extended into the afterworld. Our world here and the world to come. Because of what Adam and Eve did in the garden. By Satan's guile, he not only brought sin into this world, but he won himself dominion over it. His dominion really is the sin of the world, but he also had the sin of the afterworld, right? That gets into the "you surely will die," and I won't get into all that right now, but the fact is that's the way things stood. And when Christ was crucified, his crucifixion ultimately, without getting into the details, brought victory over Satan, which we Christians of every stripe, you know, Orthodox, Roman Catholics, and Protestants all alike, recognize as a victory over death. What does that mean? Well, that means the dominion that Satan had over the afterlife, the netherworld, was eradicated. And what happened was that Jesus, right, you know that he was crucified and he died, and you know that on the third day he resurrected. In between his death on the cross and the resurrection, he went down into Hades. But he went to the side of paradise, Abraham's bosom, and he freed those people there. But he left the other ones on the side of basically hell, torment. But that's up for Jesus. He's the judge now of the living and the dead, and the control of the dead has been taken away from Satan. That's a whole lot. It's way more than I wanted to get into right now. But I say that because once you are in the afterlife, it's very questionable whether the whole premise of free will continues on. This I'm not sure of. It might not be questionable at all to a priest, right? But one thing I do know is we still have free will here. In the land of the living, we have free will. And because we have free will, the authority of Satan over us cannot be taken back. It cannot be ripped away from us. So I don't know what happens with free will in the afterlife, but I know that Satan has been taken out of that picture. And he'll be taken out of this picture eventually too, at some point. It may happen soon. You hear a lot of people tell it, but you know, we'll see what we see. So, Jesus had victory over death, but we the living still have free will. So even though Jesus' victory over Satan freed those in Hades, it still left us susceptible to Satan. Still left this world a world of sin. Does that make sense? So life is a proving grounds of basically our will to do good. And everything we have, by our free will, we have the choice of good and evil. You know, we have to learn to recognize what is good and what is evil, and then we make our choices accordingly. And Now, the only way to do that is really, as I think of it, you put the face of God on it. You have a choice. You got the choice A, choice B. You put the face of God, overlay it on either of them, and which of them lights up, and which of them goes dark, you know? Which of them makes sense? It's sort of like what they used to do way back, you know, with the what would Jesus do? Those little bracelets, you know, little Protestants ran around. But it's not bad. It's not bad, a little trick to remind yourself, you know, when you have a decision to make. What would Jesus do? Okay? What Jesus would do is what he would have you do 100% of the time, unless it's something supernatural. But again, you know, the more practiced we are at these things, the more supernatural ability starts to flow through us. That's what saints are made out of, you know, people who are canonized, is that the word, as a saint. They have to display a life of miracle working, or at least the results of their life may display miracle working in some cases. We have, all right, here, just to bring a little bit of post-Arlen into this, theological discussion that I've fell into. The priest of my church trained up, in fact, both of the priests, we have two priests now, both of them trained up under this guy out of Dallas, right? We have a cathedral in Dallas, Orthodox Cathedral, who was the bishop, right, for the area. And this guy died some years ago, or way before my time as an Orthodox, you know, way before it. And he was buried in the Orthodox manner. Now, the Orthodox manner is they don't, like, gut you. You don't go through all that mortician stuff. You just kind of get dressed up in your suit, thrown in a box, and underground you go, right? And this guy had to be exhumed and moved from one place to another for whatever reason. And in the process, when they opened up his casket, after like some 5 or 6 years or something like that, I don't know what the exact number was, but it was a matter of years, he did not decompose at all. And that is the sort of thing like Orthodoxy would look at as something miraculous. It'll at least tell a report of the condition of this guy in the end. And he might end up being like a saint, a literal Orthodox saint out of Dallas at some point in some time as a result of that. But that's a little side jag. But that happened here in DFW, right in Dallas. And the continuity of that guy remains at that cathedral, right? The people who learned from him are there, but they're also in my little offshoot church up Plano, right? Plano Allen up that away. And yeah, it's really incredible stuff. There's a lot of mysticism, right? There is miracles and mysticism in this world. The deeper we go into our Christian faith, the more that happens. Most of us who have any kind of spiritual notions whatsoever, we go the easy way and we conjure up demons, right? We conjure up demons to try to control in order to get what we want. This is how we played the game. I did this shit. I know what I'm talking about. I did this shit. And there's a price to pay. It's, in fact, a guy used to come to our church who has moved on, but he was a movie producer, right? A fledgling movie producer in Hollywood. He made a horror movie and, you know, of course I bought a copy of it. Got it. I don't watch horror movies generally anymore, but I watched his, and one part of it that was striking was there was an actual scene where the guy was actually conjuring a demon, and when the demon came up conjured, he just looked right at the guy and just devoured him. He attacked him immediately, right? The person who set that demon free, called him into being here, just attacked his hero. And that, to me, was great art. That scene sticks with me, right? of the whole movie, that was the part that really stuck with me. Because that's what happens. The devils just turn on you. That's all they do. You think you're going to control this shit, and you don't. They turn on you, and then you're like, you know, a year later, you wonder why you're so fucked up. You know, why did I have all the fucking problems that I had in my life? Well, it started with this super unknown putting his finger on me when I was a little kid, you know, and it perpetuated by whatever wicked somebody did to me that I'm unaware of, that I responded poorly to. But eventually in my life, I would come to discount God as an answer to anything, and then I would turn, you know, yet spiritual, not atheist, I would turn to what other available spiritual entities there were to deal with. And I didn't know what I was doing when I was a kid. And I beset myself with all kinds of evil that I had no understanding of. And it took me years and years and years to scratch my fucking way out of it. It's more or less a contract to sell your soul to the devil, and then you have the balls to rip it the fuck up and tell the devil to go eat shit and turn back the other way against him. It's not part of the deal, but it got done. You can do it. You can do it. It takes a long time. Perseverance, that word again, right? Wow, I just went off on Jag. It's all contiguous. It's truth, and it's on those lines. You know, that we have, that, again, my concept is that this world is a proving grounds, right? Choosing love over hate, our will to do good in all situations, it's a proving grounds. Ultimately, you know, I use that word communion fairly recently, right? And part of this, right? Part of the proving grounds is our willful communion with the Creator of all things. So here we are. Here we are. And what do? We do what we do. We do what we do, and then what is done to us is what is done to us. And this is how we are all victimized continually, right? Every little fucking thing. And we do it unawares. I complain here on my shitty job, my literally shitty job, about the literally shitty things that literally shitty people do, right? Throw trash on the floor, right? For example, like that. Right there. That's a fucking... You might not think of that as sinful, but its reverberations are. In this world, again, it's not in the Bible, thou shalt not throw paper towel on the floor. It's not in the Bible like that, but it's absolutely fucking disrespectful. And you know in your heart it's the wrong thing to do when you're doing it. You wouldn't want nobody to do it to you. Don't do it to nobody else, right? Kind of the golden rule. Easy to go by, whatever it may be. We don't have to get all litigious and go by the book and word for word. You know what wrong is. You know what wrong is. You know it inherently. I said it before. But see, because the world is the way it is, because we've got, you know, this fucking net of sin draped over us and connecting us like, you know, a network out of hell, because we got Satan ruling over, because we got demons moving in and amongst us, living under our own skin, whispering in our fucking ears temptations night and day, right? Because we are all subjected to this sin. We are all victims. We were innocent. We are all victims. In our innocence, we are not excused from the personal responsibility to fight and win this battle, ultimately. I want to say to behave better, you know, to not respond in kind. We have a personal responsibility to stop evil in its tracks, right? Somebody does something to us, when we pay it forward, either in direct response to whoever did it or to somebody else, we're just propagating the evil. We're moving it on those network lines, person to person, right? Just pushing evil around. And, you know, the adage, You know, what goes around comes around, comes into play, right? Because we're all connected like that. You fuck somebody, you know. Oh, I don't want to get into all the examples, but the point is, our own personal responsibility as quote unquote moral individuals is to take this evil and stop it in its tracks. And I'm going to get more into this stuff as we go. We got those two choices right there: stop evil in its tracks or pay it forward. You know. I can just feel. I don't have audience when I'm recording these monologues, but I can feel audience out there and all the different kind of reactions they'll have listening to this stuff. Why? Because I've taught Bible, I've preached Bible, I've had conversations with people here and there involving Bible and God and Jesus and all these things that are coming into this particular line of monologues right now. And I just have a sense for it. I know that there's somebody out there just resisting everything I'm talking about, right? If I tell you something, if I breach a subject as like personal and as, I'm going to say it, important to so many of us as, I like to lighten the blow by saying, knuckle fucking, okay? Right? Jerking off. Something so personal, but yet important. Did you ever think about your masturbation as important to you? Did you ever really, like, quantify the importance of your knuckle fucking in your life? I don't know. I don't know that people do that or not. But when that's something you do every day, sometimes multiple times a day, I'd call that pretty significant. That is something that, like, you're scheduling time aside for every fucking day of your life, sometimes twice or three times, right? That's important. Do you ever think about that, how important it is to you? So when I breach the subject of something of importance and tell you that it is an immoral act, you're going to bristle. You're not going to like to hear that. You don't want to hear that. Your natural reaction is to dismiss and discount me, or discount and dismiss, whatever order you prefer, right? And then your mind will logically start to work in the direction of trying to justify what it is you do. The justification of unnatural behavior or immoral behavior, right? Immoral is really against nature. It is against good, all that, for every reason in the world, you know? And you can argue it till the cows come home. There's a million shades of the resistance against morality, a million shades of resisting morality. There's all kinds of justifications that we can pull. We talked about science before, data and how you can manipulate. That's exactly what our minds do when our little creature comforts start to get slapped around like I'm doing to y'all now, right? But here's the thing, you know, you don't like morality, you don't like morals, but you like the sense of being an innocent victim, right? You like the sense of being a victim, you like the sense of being innocent in what you do. But let me tell you something, there ain't no such thing as innocence if there ain't no such thing as morals. Judgment needs to be made in all kinds of situations, whether it be by God, whether it be by people, right? Judgment comes into play, and you have to have a basis for your judgment, which means there has to be some kind of rule to dictate that which is right that from that which is wrong. If there is no right and wrong, there is no innocence. Or guilt, for that matter, but there is no innocence. And that's why people go into a mindset of nihilism so easily when they are lambasted with sin and completely indulge in evil activity. The defense mechanism, the knee-jerk reaction, is to deny the strictures of God. Pretend that God don't even exist, or it doesn't matter whether he does or not, and live your existence ignoring the realities of both innocence and guilt. It's the idea, and it's really a dystopia. It's really, you know, internally. It's your lawless world. It's your lawless look. It's your worldview of a world that has no law, has no rules. There is no right or wrong. And it's anarchy is what it is. It's Aleister Crowley. It's do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. We're just saying there's no law. You just do whatever the fuck you want to do. And that's what it all comes home to. When the chickens come home to roost, there's where it's going. To our own little cube of our self-indulgence, of our desires, of our wants. And we weigh these things in the balance, our wants versus what is good and what is love. And we settle for what is evil and what is hate because we have given into the temptation. And giving into the temptation once makes you susceptible the next time. And you give into it again. And it goes deeper and deeper. It owns you more and more. You're indebted more and more. And you're fucking jaded along the way. This is what happens. See, I keep on bringing up your knuckle fuckery. I say yours because I don't do that. Right? So in this case, it's yours. I have my sin, but that ain't it. But odds are, it's yours. How does that get worse? How does that progressively get worse? When you are jerking off, what happened? What are you doing? Usually there's pornography involved. It starts out with a Sears catalog and the bra section. And it goes into pornography. And then the pornography gets into weirder and weirder pornography. Instead of just looking at a naked girl, now you want to look at two naked girls. Instead of seeing two naked girls, you want to see two naked girls doing odd shit to each other, like kissing and rubbing. And instead of that, then you want to see them doing what? Like sticking fucking objects in all their orifices, right? And then you want to see like a dude mixed in. And then you did the. Then what? Midgets and whatever. You know, you just start getting into all animals. You start bringing in all this shit because nothing satisfies. And this is the way the devil works, right? So I go on that line, down that trail with pornography. How you get jaded and how you just need more and more to titillate you, right? The same line goes with the narcotics. The devil plays the same trick. And all of a sudden, when everything is fucked up, you looked around, how the hell did I get here? Right? You start smoking a little pot, next thing you know, you're a fucking junkie in the street. And what are you doing that whole time? Well, the pot doesn't really satisfy no more. It comes to a point where all it does is make you paranoid, so you move on to another drug. And that seems okay for a moment, and then it starts getting weird. And then you go on to another, and you start mixing them. Become a garbage head like I did. I would just take everything all the time, you know? I tell a story about cocaine. All the cocaine I did, all of the cocaine I did. You know how many times I did only cocaine and nothing else? One time. And that was only because we were snowed in, you know? One time. But anyway, yeah, I was a garbage head. No innocence without morals, a lawless world, right? The idea of a lawless world is really a devilish mentality. I associate it with Aleister Crowley, who is famous for that quote, you know, thou do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And just think about all the world. You want to do that because you want to avoid the morality, because you want to keep on going deeper and deeper into your perversions, or deeper and deeper into your addictions. If you actually had a world of that kind of lawlessness, how would you like to experience someone like me? Unfucking hinged. How would you like if Jesus came up to me one day and just said, you know what, Maverick? Let it rip, man. No holding back. You've proved yourself my son. I want you to go through the world and just do what you feel like doing on any impulse that you might have. Whatever pisses you off, go with it. You want to live in a world like that? You want to live in a world where I'm running around free to do whatever? You want to run in a world where there's 10 million of me running around doing that? That's your lawlessness. Draw the complete picture when you're imagining your imaginations, okay? Because we tend to be selfish. We tend to be selfish fucking people. And all we see is what's in it for us. But we don't see what's coming for us. It might be Maverick 88, but it'll probably be the devil himself. And what am I saying about me, you know? If I was lawless, well, you would have a world of bullies. If there was a world of me running around unhinged, unbridled, there would be bullies everywhere. You would be getting bullied. I promise you. And I know that that's exactly the kind of thing you fucking hate. It becomes a world not of morality, right? We live in a world that has law. The law is actually based on Christian morals for the most part. But of course, we've got sin in this world, and the law is manipulated all kinds of ways. So it's as much bullshit as our science is, right? But there are some basic things that are pretty much held to, you know. We have some kind of general social agreement that we subscribe to collectively that takes us away from a society that's run amok. It's not an anarchy as long as you have a legal system. Right? But as soon as you take a legal system away and you think it's just going to be free and everybody's going to dance around and pick the wildflowers and smoke pot and have free love, no. There's always going to be law. It's just a matter of whose it is. There's always going to be might makes right. So whatever power is in control now, you take that away, there will be another power. It's, I'm going to bring the Who, right? Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. It's a song, Won't Get Fooled Again, from the Who's next album. And I'm going to come back to that later on in time, too. But not that song, but a different song from the same album, right? But Won't Get Fooled Again has that famous line. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. That's what it means. You're going to do everything in your power. The revolutionary, right? The Antifa, the big revolutionary. We're going to have our revolution. And what are you going to do? If you succeed, you're going to take one power out of power and replace it with what? The same fucking asshole with a different name and suit. Because that's what it is. Might makes right. Where do we give the power? Where's the authority, you know? Questions ask yourself. Having law, having morals specifically, right? They become the parameters for what is innocent and what is guilty, right? They become the parameters of judgment, of justice. There has to be something. Why? All right, and I said before, earlier, early on, about my nature as a defender of the innocent, right? I got it in my composition, in my constitution. This is just, I can't not do that. But my problem would be disseminating innocence in a situation. I have to have a basis of right and wrong in everything that I observe, or else I cannot act. I cannot defend innocent if I cannot recognize innocent. And I cannot recognize innocent if there is no rule or no law of determination. So if you're innocent and you want to be protected and you get a protector like me come along, I can't protect you. Because I don't know if you're innocent. What kind of world do you want to live in? See, I draw that picture and I use me as the example, but take me away and make it a police officer. When you are being raped and a cop is right there looking at you and you're wondering why he's not doing anything, well, because there's nothing in the rules that say this guy can't rape you. You don't want a lawless world, I promise you that. I promise you that. Everybody, every single person's got some degree of moral resistance. We have these choices. They wouldn't be a fucking choice if what was wrong for us to do wasn't so inviting, if it wasn't a temptation, right? Because the temptation is so strong, and then once we succumb to it, it becomes so encompassing to us. It has this way of taking over and driving us. Naturally, to quote-unquote do the next right thing becomes a real challenge. We have an aversion to goodness. And it is seemingly part of our nature, but it is not. It really is not. I always thought it was. Even as a Christian, I always thought that this aversion to God was part of my nature. It's not. The goodness is how we're born. We get invaded. Everything in the Garden of Eden, in a Garden of Eden, baby, right? Everything in the Garden of Eden was groovy. It was fucking paradise. Even with the tree of knowledge of good and evil there, even with God laying that one command, that one morality on the two, you know, our earliest ancestors, Adam and Eve, there was no problem until along comes the serpent. The serpent had to come along. The serpent had to tell Adam and Eve that God was full of shit. The serpent had to tell them that they can be like God. They don't have to listen to God anymore. That's what had to happen to bring humanity into sin. So no, we're not born like that. It comes and finds us. The serpent comes and finds us all and tells us that God sucks. And every time we have temptation to do something that is rubbing against us, every time we have temptation, and I'm going to use this word, but I'm going to get into it in a minute, okay? So I know it's coming, right? I know it's coming. Every time we have temptation that brings us into conflict with our conscience, that's an important word. Conscience, that's why I said it like that. It's an important word. Every time we have temptation that brings us into conflict with our conscience, we are in the precarious moment of making a choice for ourselves. The temptation is magnified exponentially by demons whispering in our ears. So I say it was no problem to have that forbidden fruit hanging around in the Garden of Eden until the serpent came along. You could look at it and say, you know, I'd like to take a bite out of that. But God said not to, so I won't. There's other shit to eat over there. That would be natural. What becomes unnatural is when that serpent comes into the garden and beguiles Eve. So we have this moral resistance anyway. I'm kind of going off on it, you know. We have this resistance to morality. And it develops. It comes from Satan. It comes from demons. It comes from evil. It's part of the whole network of sin that makes the world the world. You know, it's the kingdom of Satan, as I described earlier. And it's something that's kind of, it's a contagion that we take in, this resistance. And it is developed. Just like you would develop anything else you want to grow. Like you water a plant, you know. That contagion, which is sin, is developed by more of the same. Whatever got it into your system in the first place keeps on coming back and keeps on doing. Keeps on tempting. Keeps on compromising you. Keeps on breaking you. Keeps on making you vulnerable. Keeps inviting its friends to come in who do the same shit. And so on and so on and so on down the line. Right? And somewhere along the line, we kind of accept it all as a dancing partner, and we just start doing the fucking tango, you know? We get along with it. We get along. We get used to doing wrong. We get used to blotting out that conscience, right? Anyway, I mean, the moral resistance is the prevailing worldview on Earth. It is far and wide popular. We are generally a world who has bought into the lie. We are generally a world that has, well, let me just say it like this, and I'm probably going to get to this too later on, way later on, but later on. Jesus came into the world. That's God coming into the world in the form of a man, right? So God comes to the world. And what does the world do? It mocks him. It slaps him around, abuses him, and then executes him, kills him. That's what we do. And most of us on this earth are doing that very thing every single day. And many of us on this earth are crying out for God in moments of despair. And as soon as we get through that emotionally, we turn around and do the same thing the next day. We mock God, we slap him around, we abuse him, we execute him, kill him. Nobody's perfect. Everybody has sin. No one is without sin. But there are some people who have taken God on his terms, like I say so frequently. And most have not. I'm going to tell you, this is a proving ground. This is not a fucking popularity contest. Two completely different things. This moral resistance can be overcome. It has been overcome many, many times, many, many people. You got to want to. It doesn't just happen. Events may happen that push you in the direction of wanting to. You may have that moment of desperation where you do a foxhole prayer. Right? They say there's no atheist in a foxhole. Right? Bullets are flying, bombs are blowing up. Three people next to you had their fucking guts ripped out and their head tore off. Fucking machine gun fire. You're kneeling down in a pool of blood and you're fucking next. And you think you're an atheist. Good luck. Good luck. It's all pretend. It's all pretend. It's a part of everybody's personal utopia. This resistance to morality is the same resistance to God, based on the lie that Satan told to Eve in the garden. That's why I'm going there. It's been this way from the beginning. The way I see it, the whole want to, overcome a resistance to morality and get with the program, join the winning team, right? It really comes basically in two forms. Internal, external, right? Like an extrovert and an introvert. We look out, right? This is the first way. We look out at the world. And we can reason by the evidence of the corruptedness of the world. Like, the world obviously sucks, right? The deeper you go into a city, the more suckage there is. Because why? Humanity is compounded, right? The density of a population is a compounded humanity, and the suckage is greater. And people who live in that shit have a really fucked up outlook. They have no idea what the rest of the world is because we're selfish like that, right? Our world view is in the canyons of Manhattan or in the projects up in Harlem, right? Manhattan too, but we don't know that there's this like gazillion acres out there of open prairie and forest land and huge mountain chains, a couple of them, you know, endless seas of water, no people to be seen anywhere around. There's no concept of that. It's not part of our reality in the city. But anyway, I'm talking about the density of it, you know. If you don't think the world sucks, just keep on going into the city, deeper to the city, into the city. The closer you get to the heart of a city, the more suckage you encounter. Why? Because it's humans that create suckage. It is. It just is. So you got the evidence of a corrupt world in that. All right. And then now the details. What? people getting raped, people getting mugged, people getting murdered, people getting defrauded, people being extorted. What happens in a city, right? That's the shit that happens in a city. When you put so many people together in close proximity to one another, and some one person is desperate, they're going to do an act like that, and that's going to fuck up somebody who's going to turn around and do something else to somebody else, and so on and so on and so on. And the more people in a small area, the more frequent these types of events are, the more obvious the sickness in our society is. But you can catch it anywhere. You can go out to the wildest wilds and you'll start to see all the crazies, right? Out in the hillbillies with the inbreeding and shit like that, abusive people, with pedophilia, you know that old story, right? The idea of the inbred hillbilly. Evil is everywhere people are. We're the carriers. We are the carriers. And at the behest of demons, we become the perpetuators. Anyway. We have reason by evidence of the corrupt world. And if we accept that as evidence, and that becomes reasonable to us, we can begin to get along with the program at that point. We no longer can rely on humanity. We can no longer trust the science, for example. Say you trusted the science and you took their fucking vaccination. And maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, your dick falls off. Oh. Do you trust the science anymore after that? Probably not. Many of us are medically skeptical. And there's reasons for that. Many of us are not, and it's because they haven't come to reason. But you can come to reason in that case, or in the case of your moral resistance. You can come to reason. You can be honest and decide that humanity sucks. This world sucks, right? What do you do? I just ran into a guy, an old friend of mine, right? I haven't seen him in a little while. We're still Facebook friends, but we just have, our paths haven't crossed for whatever reason. I was out here doing my work, and he pulled up. He snuck up behind me, kind of, but I saw his reflection coming, and I could tell it was him. So I knew, and as soon as he said something, I knew by his accent and everything. He's from Wisconsin. They got their accent. and he told me, he's been having health problems, right? He just had surgery a couple of weeks ago, and I got a little inquisitive about it. I care. I give a shit. And, he's got cancer. Or he had a chunk of cancer. That's what the surgery was about. But look, the rest of the story is this. He lives a life. He's an ordinary dude, football fan. Works, has a house, a little boat, goes out on the lake, loves his woman, and they're good, and, everything is happy ever after, right? And he retired, 2 years ago, something like that. He worked out his whole life and got to the age where he could retire, and what happens? He gets cancer. This is reality. This is the life. And what do? You're a work-a-day Joe, doing shit. Every day, I'm sure, he's not driving in, pulling up in the parking lot and saying, yeah, let's go get him, for 40 fucking years. Oh, he's like me. When I get out, I jump out of my truck. I'm like, I can't fucking believe I'm here again. What a waste of time. There's so many better things that I ought to be doing right now. But I got to make the fucking money to pay for everything that got to get done, right? And we all chip into this fucking world. The kingdom of Satan, right? That's the a difficulty, it's a reality, but when you do overcome your resistance to morality, you will find yourself a Christian person of one sort or another. It goes hand in hand. And you're going to find that you basically got like one foot in the kingdom of Satan in the world here, and then you got another foot in the kingdom of heaven. And you're living out a real full knowledge of good and evil. What do I mean by that? When you're ignoring morality, when you're turning your back on God, when you're pretending he's not there, that's what I think an atheist is, right? An atheist is defined by somebody who doesn't, you know, technically doesn't believe in supernatural spirituality, afterlife, things like that, right? It's all the here and now. And they rely on science to try to perfect the world and try to extend life. But really, the truth about an atheist is it's somebody who's pretending that God don't exist. That's what it really boils down to. When you understand that we're in a proving ground, atheism is a way to conveniently label yourself as an ignoramus. There's no better way to put it. In fact, you know, the Bible calls such a man a fool, you know, in many different places, Old Testament and New alike. Literally a fool. It's not my word. Don't get all pissy about me, you know. Where was I going with all of that? I'm going like 10 different directions and just trying to plow through here and get to where I'm going. We are in a corrupt world. And, I was talking about the fullness of the experience of living with the knowledge of good and evil, right? And we ignore the good and we pretend that we're not evil. That's what we do. We don't pretend that evil doesn't exist. We don't call it evil, necessarily. We probably do anyway, but bad, unfortunate, whatever, you know. We may sugarcoat it. We may use like quote-unquote non-biblical terminology, non-Christian words. But if we're turning our back on God, we're pretending God isn't there, if we're being an ignoramus, if we're being a fool, playing the fool, as they say down south, right? If we're playing the fool, there he go, playing the fool. You're not taking in the good of things. You're just not. You're not recognizing it. You're not recognizing it for the good. You're nullifying it. You're not having the full experience. You have sensations. You know, when things are good for you, you may find joy in it. But most of the things you think are good for you are actually immoral. That's what you knuckle fucking, you know, and you got a new fucking Playboy in the mail. Oh, that's good, right? Well, no, not really. You think it is, but it ain't. Oh, man. I gotta move on. I gotta move on from this. What I'm in the middle of talking about here is reason by evidence of a corrupt world, the corruptedness of the world, the recognition of its corruptedness. What I'm saying is, if you're turning your back on God, your eyes are already kind of blinded to the fact of it. That's just what happens. You take God out of the picture, you start taking the fact of good and evil away with it too. And now you're blind to your own sin, right? And when you're taking God out of the world, you get into the practice of blotting out your conscience. Now, I'm just about to finally get into that, right? We're just moments away. And that's a big deal. So stick around for that, right? Reason by evidence of a corrupt world, right? Let's go through the reasoning, right? I already described the corruption of humanity, right? That deeper dive, deeper into denser population, right? But not restricted to that. It doesn't mean people go in the other direction, way out in the country, are all holy and shit neither. It ain't like that. I don't mean it to be. Wherever there's people, there are problems, right? But you got the wonder of nature opposed to that, right? You go out in the country, yeah, you're going to find that odd fucking hillbilly with the moonshine raping his fucking daughter, maybe. But you move on from him, go over the hill, and you're just going to see miles and miles of forest and wilderness. And you stand in a place like that where you can see creation minus humanity. And you, every one of us has the sense of awe and majesty in that moment. We have a sudden recognition of the almighty creator of all things. We cannot help it. It's in our nature. But we try to pretend it's otherwise. If we are ignoramus and fools and et cetera, so forth, right? By reason of evidence of the corruptness of the world, the corruptness of humanity, humanity being the world, and versus the wonder of nature without humanity, right? This is what I'm trying to say. Minus humanity, everything just seems so great, good, you know? Wonderful is a good word for it. Majestic. But where you put humanity in, it's all kind of fucked up and corrupt and wicked and dangerous. You know, it becomes all that all of a sudden. We know these things to be true. We know that that comparison is real. It does serve as the foundation of evidence that we need mentally to come to terms against our resistance to morality and get with the program. The beginning is there. What is the beginning of wisdom? The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And the fear really means respect. That could have been translated to say respect. It's an understanding that God is something to be feared. In other words, God is something way greater that you cannot contend with and ever expect to win. Your wisdom begins there. And you go down that path of wisdom with the start of recognizing God as being God and respecting His power and authority. You will start to gain in wisdom. You can be very knowledgeable about all kinds of things. You can be intellectual. You can be highly scientific and technological. You could be gifted in many, many different ways. But wisdom is something that comes from a perspective gained by bowing down to God. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Wisdom upon us is different than intelligence and intellect. Maybe someday I'll talk about that more. That's not on the agenda right now.
The Downcome series continues in the next release of Post-Harlan Monologics.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Harlan Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Harlan Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at post-harlan.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@post-harlan.com.